Good afternoon, you are tuned to Juno Afternoon here for Thursday, the 18th of February, the year 2016. Jeff Bowder here with me today. We'll talk with Dana Stubner from the Alaska Historical Museum about this week's UAS Sound and Motion series, Treasures from the Stateful Archives. Brenda Weaver from Farside Books will be here to highlight the African Book Project. We'll meet members of the award-winning high school regional robotics spinning team, and Nancy DeCherney will be here with ArtsApp. That music and more. Writer's Almanac here on a June afternoon, repeated at 4 a.m. on FM and on demand by KTVO.org. Weather forecast for tonight, clear skies, low temperatures 15 to 25. Forecast for Friday, mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of snow in the afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The number of murdered and missing Aboriginal women in Canada since the 1980s is much higher than at first believed. That's the assessment of Canadian government ministers who've been holding consultations across the country. Dan Karpinchuk has more.
Canada's Minister of Indigenous Affairs, Carolyn Bennett, says it's much more than just about numbers. A couple of days ago, she said the numbers were far higher than believed. A Royal Canadian Mounted Police report from 2014 suggested that there were 1,200 missing and murdered Aboriginal women across Canada since the 1980s. Bennett created a stir this week when she said the real numbers were much higher and the magnitude of the problem much greater. She insists she has no hard data on the actual numbers other than anecdotal evidence.
What we're seeing now is that things that were called a suicide, things that were called an accident, these are the cases where the families really want this looked into, because at the minute the police call it a suicide or an accident or natural causes or an overdose, it means there's no investigation.
Bennett says it's very important that the coming inquiry looks at the root causes and the vulnerability of Native women. Meanwhile, the Minister for the Status of Women says the numbers could go as high as 4,000. She says that's based on a history of police underreporting or failing to properly investigate cases of missing and murdered Aboriginal women. And the head of the Native Women's Association of Canada also maintains that the inquiry must be all-encompassing so that effective solutions can be put in place. She says many women who escaped violence alive should also be considered. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The Buffalo Field Campaign is holding rallies near Yellowstone National Park this week. Spokespeople for the group say the goal is to educate the public about Yellowstone's buffalo herd and protest the long-standing practice of killing buffalo that wander out of the park into Montana. Jim Kent reports.
The Buffalo Field Campaign was founded in 1997 by Lakota elder Rosalie Little Thunder and Mike Meese. Their goal was to stop the killing of buffalo that left Yellowstone National Park during the winter through their natural migratory routes into Montana. Mike Meese says the reason given for those killings has been concern over the spread of brucellosis from the herd. The bacterial disease can cause udder infections in cattle.
Basically, there is a zero-tolerance policy for what are now confined to Yellowstone bison to take a step outside of Yellowstone into the state of Montana. When they do so, they're met with a hunt, which starts November 15th and carries on through the month of March.
Yellowstone Park spokesperson Sandra Snell Dilbert doesn't dispute this claim and notes that the buffalo hunt does include tribal entities. But for the Lakota, says Karen Little Thunder, the buffalo are considered relatives.
It's difficult enough to see any animal get killed senselessly, but to see our relatives get killed like that is extremely heart-wrenching.
The Buffalo Fields Campaign disputes concerns over the spread of brucellosis and claims there is no documented case of buffalo-to-cattle transmission. The group has a rally scheduled in West Yellowstone on Friday. Sandra Snell Dilbert concedes that 350 Yellowstone bison have been killed in this year's hunt. Mike Meese notes that 8,000 have been killed since the late 90s. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
The Junior Native Youth Olympic Games kick off Friday and run through the weekend in Chugiak, Alaska. Coaches, families, and spectators will gather to celebrate the strength, agility, and determination of athletes at the Games. More than 600 students, grades 1st through 6th, from across the state are expected to compete in traditional Alaska Native contests, such as the high kick, arm pull, and seal hop. The Junior Olympics serve as a training ground for the Senior Games, which will be held in April in Anchorage. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who've had their day one at nativenews.net. Support by VisionMaker Media, whose mission is to empower and engage Native people to tell stories. On February 20th, VisionMaker Media celebrates 40 years of advancing Native culture, heritage, wisdom, sacred stories, and the storyteller. More at visionmakermedia.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's about 6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to Juno Afternoon. I'm Jeff Brown. I'm your host for today. And our first guest in the studio is Damon Snubner from the Alaska State Historical Library. Damon, thank you for coming down.
Thanks, Jeff.
So, the Alaska State Historical Library, how many items are in that collection?
We were talking about this before we came on the air. And to be honest, I really don't know. It is pretty a mass. As far as the volume, I would say we probably have close to 1,000 films and videos in our collection.
What kind of format are they in?
Name a video format that's been around since probably about the 1960s, and we have a copy of it, Betamax, 8mm, Beta-SP, 3/4 inch, 1 inch, pretty much name that. We have 35mm motion picture film, 16mm motion picture film, 8mm motion picture film. So our collection pretty much spans the history of media.
And you have to transfer it all to digital at some point.
At some point, yeah. That is our goal, to transfer it all to digital. I have a very large collection of vintage video and film players that a lot of my colleagues say should be in a museum, but they're being used.
How do you store something like that?
Well, as of right now, things are pretty much in a basic environment. But in the new building, the motion picture films are actually going to be stored in an actual freezer environment, a cool environment to slow down the rate of decay, as well as the videotapes as well. They're going to be in an environment that's going to help preserve them.
How do they arrive there?
A lot of times we get is just a donation. Somebody finds this movie film or videotape that they think is worthy of saving, and they bring it in or contact us with it.
And that must be some kind of a process, because some of the stuff I imagine is just not worth keeping.
Sometimes I'm involved in that, sometimes I'm not. But a lot of times you really don't know what you have until you actually put it in the machine and play it. In some cases, while you're doing that, you might as well digitize it while you're doing it, just in case it is something really of value.
Over the years, has there been a handful of times that you've opened, or you pressed play on a machine and your jaw just dropped open?
Yes. Yeah. I can. The one thing that comes to my mind is a couple years ago we had an open reel. You have to picture a very large videotape that had an exposed video reel to it. We had a hard time getting that digitized because I didn't have the machinery to do it, and we kept sending it away to different companies to get it digitized, and most of the places that we sent it to said they couldn't do it for one particular reason. When we finally found a company that digitized it, we got the videotape back, and it was the speech by Senator Ted Kennedy in Sitka just a few days after the death of Martin Luther King, for which we played on our very first Sound and Motion event that we had 7 years ago.
The Sound and Motion event starting tomorrow night.
It is tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the UAS Egan Lecture Hall.
In general, how can people view, without going to the Sound and Motion picture event?
Well, I actually would love for them to come because they need to see things on big screen. But at the in our digitizing process, we do make DVDs. Certain films that we have digitized are going up on YouTube and other media like that. So that is ways that they can see the films.
What's going to be shown on Friday night?
What's going to be shown on Friday night? I'm showing four films. The first one is from the Heritage of Alaska series. Were created by Elmer Rasmussen, and Elmer Rasmussen will be actually talking about the very distinctive art style of artist Fred McIntont. The second film that I'm going to be showing is a documentary called Tlingit An'i, Land of the Tlingits. It's actually a beautiful, beautiful done film that basically tells the history and the culture of the indigenous people in this area as through old photos, animation, and oral histories from elders. The third film, one that you're very familiar with because it actually stars you, is...
That's enough reason to turn off the TV.
No, actually, it's actually wonderful. It's a TV commercial that was produced back in the 1980s, anti-littering commercial starring Jeff Brown here and his cohort at the time, Steve Nelson. I think it's absolutely wonderful. Come out and you can see Jeff sing and dance. So
I think you lost your audience right there.
No, I bet you I didn't. And the last is a TV documentary called The Great American Lumberjack. I don't know too much about this video, but I do know that it was produced for PBS. I don't know whether it aired or not, but it's actually a wonderful, beautiful Lee Shot documentary about the life of living at a logging camp near Ketchikan.
If people miss the program, can they view any of these online?
At the moment, the only one that is available online is the Heritage of Alaska episode with Fred McIntont, though we are working on getting some others up online. A lot of times we can't put things online because we have issues of copyright, but most of what we have has been digitized. They can certainly come into the library or even just wait until we're in the new building and come in and actually request a look at it.
Do you work with MEPA?
I don't directly, but we as the institution do.
And AMIPA is the Alaska Moving Image
Preservation Association, yes.
For people who don't know, can you tell the radio listening audience what that organization does?
They do very similar to work what we do, and their sole purpose is to actually the preservation of motion picture and video, and they are based in Anchorage.
How do you, let's say somebody passes away and they've got a collection of DVDs and CDs and media. When they submit it to you, say, save this, this is my Uncle Harry's, do you save it? Can you possibly save it all?
We try to. So, yes, we absolutely do. It depends on a lot of times on what the condition is in. We actually do try to save everything that we get as far as if it has some historical value to it. Sometimes that may not be possible, but we certainly try to.
I'm talking with Damon Steubner from the Alaska State Historical Collection Library about tomorrow night's presentation, Treasures from the State Film Archives. Damon, is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Come on out.
Eight stars of gold on a field of blue, Alaska's flag, may it mean to you. The blue of the sea, the evening sky, the mountain lakes and the flowers nearby, the gold of the early sourdough's green, the precious gold of the hills and streams, the brilliant stars in the northern sky, the bear, the dipper, and shining high, the great North Star with its steady light, o'er land and sea, a beacon bright, Alaska's flag to Alaskans dear, the same.
It's about 15 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to Juno Afternoon. In the studio with me now is Susan Hickey, formerly the owner of Hearthside Books, and Brenda Weaver, the current owner. Thank you for coming to the station.
Thank you.
Fun, Jeff.
So we're here today to talk about the African book drive.
Yes. We're excited.
Susan, why don't you tell me a little bit about the history of that, please?
Well, in 2009, I read a book about a gal who went to Africa and took libraries by camelback out into the bush. I think it was sub-Saharan Africa. Anyway, I was spurred to learn more about it. Learned about the African Library Project, started by Chris Bradshaw of California. It's a completely nonprofit organization. It's been going on for 10 years. And I have their latest newsletter. The African Library Project has now sent 1,800 books to Africa.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And Hearthside has sent, we were talking today, we think Juno has sent about 8,000 books to schools in Africa.
What's the deadline for people who want to submit something?
We have to ship them out by maybe March 15th, so we're under a quick deadline to collect those 1,000 titles.
And how can people donate?
They can drop books off at either location of Hearthside Book. There's a big orange box, paper-covered box, and we can take any books that are not religious or holiday theme, of course, because we have different holidays and things like that. They are primary grades, so it's pre-K through grades 6. And any teaching materials, teachers that want to get rid of things like that, so any gently used books. They're very excited. Last year we sent about 1,500 books to Swaziland. This year we're working on a school in Ghana that has 600 students. They've gone from 25 to 600 students in the last 5 years or 10 years.
How do you get them all to Africa?
Well, we sort through them. I'm coming back to help Brenda do this. Sort through every single book, look at it, make sure it's appropriate and in good condition. I pack them up. They go in garbage bags inside sturdy boxes, lots and lots and lots and lots of tape. We send them through the post office to a place in Louisiana that Chris Bradshaw, she rents storage space. And then when they get enough to fill a van, an ocean-going van, then they go across the ocean, and she has people on the ground to meet the books there to make sure that they're taken to the village, and the village has to apply for a library. The books don't just show up. There's lots of paperwork, and that's been a benefit to especially the women in the villages in Africa. They've learned how to fill out paperwork and organize things and take care of things, and their self-esteem has gone up greatly when they've worked on an African library.
Do you hear back from the people who receive the books?
We do, and they send pictures. And a couple of years ago, I got a whole pack of letters written by students, and I just sat down with a cup of coffee one day at the bookstore and thought, I'm going to just read these right now. Well, it turned out that they'd written a group letter, and then the children had copied it. So it was the same letter over and over and over again. But it was fun. It was great fun.
I mentioned the deadline, can you please be?
The deadline, we need to get them out of the inboxes and packed and out the door by March 15th. So we're going to be working through March, sorting and boxing up and counting the books that we have. And I do have to give a shout out to Juno Rotary because they donate money that helps us pay for the postage to get the books to Louisiana and on to Africa.
Yeah. In fact, it was Sharon Gateman, who I just heard today is going to be the Grand Marshal of our July 4th parade this summer. Sharon was president of Rotary in 2009 when I came to speak about books to Rotary one day at the luncheon and mentioned this idea of possibly sending books to Africa. And she was the one that stood up and said, you do it, we'll pay for it. And Rotary has been terrific. Every single year they have funded these 7 or 8 libraries. And it's several hundred dollars to do a library. So thank you, Rotary.
Is there anything you'd like to add that I've forgotten to ask?
Well, you know, we hear in the news the overwhelming problems on the continent of Africa. And I guess I feel better doing this because I feel like I'm doing something concrete that might help. I figure, you know, whatever the problem, education is often the answer. And this is something I think all of us can do. So, you know, today was spring cleaning in my garage, and so this is perfect timing, everybody. You know, dig out those books that you've been saving and bring them over to Hearthside, both stores, right away would be great. There's a lot of work to be done before they're packed up to go.
And I appreciate those that do, because we also have donations. If you don't have books, we also have a little donation can if people want to drop money in, because what any books that were short, I can either go to Friends of the Library or I can purchase books for to go in there or to help offset some of the costs and shipping as well.
And I encourage people to go online and look at the wonderful website, the African Library Project. It's completely volunteer. It's a wonderful website. You'll see great photos.
Brenda, as long as I got you here, and Susan, too, what's new in the book world?
Oh, my gosh. Well, next week we have a local former public radio and Alaska Native News reporter that is going to be visiting towns, Bonnie Sue Hitchcock, and she's got a new young adult book out. And she'll be she'll be signing on Wednesday night, and she's visiting some schools. We've got, oh, my gosh.
Larry Johansson has a book coming in.
Larry Johansson, he's going to have First Friday. We're going to have Diesel Jester, a.k.a. Jeremy Reynolds, a local author with a sci-fi. He's going to be at the mall store on Saturday, a week from Saturday. That's what's happening here locally in town, but we're also working with several other agencies to pull some authors in to help them, support them as well. We're also working on a book club corner at the mall store. New books out. Oh, my gosh. I've been ordering books through the end of summer, so there's a lot of really great titles coming out.
It's hard to imagine any book taking the place of Harry Potter, but what are some runners-up?
Game of Thrones. All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr, the Pulitzer Prize winner. That's a phenomenal read. There is a new book. I finished reading the advanced copy, Lilac Girls, which takes place during the World War II, just prior to World War II, and it follows three women in three different countries and how their lives unexpectedly come together at the end. It is a phenomenal read. It's going to be out in April.
And you help organize the book club in town.
I'm sorry?
You help organize the book club here in town?
Book clubs can order through us as well for a discount. It's free shipping, of course, but we're organizing a book club to meet in the mall space. We're going to be coming out with a calendar of events that will be a general monthly calendar so people will know what's going on. We're also working on a young adult advanced reader club so that the teenagers and adults who like young adult books, because those go up through early teens, can come in, check out advanced copies before the books come out, give us feedback, meet together, talk about them, give us some feedback on them. We get several of them, and we can't possibly read them all, so we are going to encourage our local general public to come in and help us out.
And Susan, what are you reading these days?
Oh, gosh. Lots of things. I'm in a book club, and we're reading The Roundhouse right now, Louise Ehrlich's book. Anything I can get my hands on.
Susan, Nikki, and Brenda Weaver, thank you so much for coming down. Is there anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Just please bring those books down and help us out. Get those books to the African school in Ghana this year.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming by.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you.
in Township Drive there. It's about 27 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau, Karen and FM in Juneau as well. Jordan Mackert-Shaper here to tell us about the high school regional robotics competition, and these people are winners, and I congratulate you for being the winners. Tell me, what is a robot?
Well, to me, a robot is something that can do a certain job and be able to accomplish tasks that are dangerous, dirty, and are very hard for human beings to do. In our competition, however, it's just pretty much for fun.
Yeah, we're given a game every year with specific tasks, and we get to choose which tasks we want to take on and how we want our robot to do it, so we design the robots based on that.
What does a robot look like?
They fit into an 18 by 18 inch cube, and we're given a bin of metal parts, and they pretty much say, use these to build what you want, and if you don't have a part that you need, take power tools to it until it looks like you want it to. So they can range from very symmetrical and box-like structures to crazy things you would never think of.
So you're part of the team. What was the name of your team?
My team's the all-girl team. We're Genetic Advantage.
And my team, I'm Max, and my team is the Team Duct Tape.
And my team is the Brobots Plus One.
Duct tape.
Yes.
That must be a major part of the robot.
Yeah, our robot pretty much is duct tape. We've used it in very important parts of it, especially in our name, and we decorate everything with duct tape, so it's very important to our team.
What did your team have to do?
So our team, like what we had to do was, as the challenge this year, we had to, there's two different ramps on opposite sides of the field, and as part of the challenge, you could climb up the ramps, as well as there's debris all over the field that you could pick up and dispense into baskets around the playing area.
Mm-hmm. So my robot specifically goes for that debris, collects that debris, and deposits it into a bucket. And the debris that we're getting is about 5 points each. And so we can hold about five blocks or five debris. And it's a pretty good robot.
My team focused on the climbing of the mountain. It's called the rescue mission. So the ramps are mountains, and there's little plastic zip liners on the top of each one. So the very highest point that you can get is on the cliff zone, and it's actually just a bar that you hang your robot from. So my team decided that looked like the most challenging part, and that's what we wanted to take on. So we hang from the bar at the top using a measuring tape with a hook on the end.
How do you come up with the idea?
Every year the challenge consists of something that you want some kind of an arm for, whether it's to move something out of the way or pick something up or put it somewhere. And it's always a challenge to find something that's doesn't weigh too much for the motors to handle or isn't too big for the robot. So we wanted to think of some material that would compact really easily into something small and didn't weigh very much but was strong enough to support the weight of the robot. So we thought, you know, a measuring tape is made to wind up, so we tried it, and it seemed like it may work and it may not, and then it ended up actually being exactly what we wanted.
And also, this competition is nationwide, so we can see what other people's robots are doing, and we can build off of those ideas and construct a robot that fits our needs.
How are you judged?
So there's many different awards that take place during the competition. Each team has an engineering notebook that they record their daily doings in, so that's one award which specifically focuses on that. And there's also a community outreach award where teams can focus on taking science and engineering out into the community and teaching people about that, and that's an award. And then there's also an award about winning the competition. The actual competing in the field and seeing how many points you can get.
And the main award that is the first place of the tournament, the first award to move on to the next competition, is called the Inspire Award. And it's given to the team that encompasses all of the different ideas. They have the Good Engineering Notebook, a robot that performs reliably. And then there's also a phrase that is used called gracious professionalism. That's pretty much just being a good teammate and knowing that the winner of the competition isn't as important as what you've learned throughout it. So the team that can that understands that and encompasses all of the different values is the winner of the Inspire Award, first place at the tournament.
Where was the competition held most recently?
The regional qualifier was in Sitka.
And you're on your way to the big statewide competition.
Yes, that's in Eagle River this weekend.
What are you doing to get ready for that?
So our team has had about a month to prepare from our last competition until this competition. And mostly it's just tweaking of different parts, making sure that everything works reliably, not a whole change of ideas and changing of robots. We're just tweaking, adding parts, and making sure everything's perfect.
So you get there to the main competition, and they hand you the box, and then they strike the gong and say, go. What do you do?
So for the competition, there's two parts. There's an autonomous, where you pre-program, and you have the robot do its own kind of thing. And then there's a driver period, which people have, like, Xbox controllers, and drive around the robot as if it were a video game. And so each team has their own kind of strategy, and they go about the playing field with that strategy in mind and have to change ideas and make sure that everything works as their robot wants. And they also have a team that's their alliance, and so they have to work together as an alliance to achieve a higher point value.
Schaefer, what did your team do?
So our team, in the competition, our goal was to push all the debris into a goal that was situated on the floor. And we were pretty successful doing that. Our team actually won the competition aspect as well as the Inspire aspect that Jordan was talking about. And so that's why we're moving on to state.
How'd you get interested in robots?
Well, I started robotics back in elementary school, and I was really interested in the building aspect of it, and I think that that's really going to influence my future career and interests.
Are you interested in engineering?
Yeah.
How about you, man?
For me, I'm actually very interested in mechanical engineering. I enjoy robots and how they move and programming them. And I think I'm actually going to be going. I'm going to be going to college for mechanical engineering, and robotics has really pushed me to pursue that goal, and has given me enjoyment in building robots.
Jordan, how about you?
I also started in the younger version in elementary school. It's called the First Lego League. We're the First Technical Challenge, and First Lego League is robots made out of Legos. So I started in that program, and I really liked being able to take control and help other people figure it out. So I got really interested in the leadership aspect of it. And then moving on to high school, it's been really exciting to get to come up with ideas that are a little bit more complicated than the Lego robots. You really have to think outside of the box, and I like being able to take other parts that they don't give you and really come up with something unique. So that's definitely helped me, and I'm also looking into engineering as a career.
What do you have to do to get prepared for that? Do you have any idea what the kind of tasks they're going to give you?
Every year is a new game, so we don't know what the game's going to be until the release, which is in, like, September, I think, every year. So we can't know exactly what our robots are going to have to do. There's always some general rules about, like, sizing and tools, and we can use things that we've learned in past competitions to think ahead. But as far as getting ready for the actual competitions, there's a lot of, obviously, your robot, you want your robot to be ready, and there's also an interview that happens the night before the game. So that's a lot of preparing and talking to your team, getting to know everybody, and giving out, you know, divvying out the information so everybody has something to talk about. That takes a lot of practice.
What kind of tools are you allowed to take with you? A screwdriver?
To the competition?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's a limit on what we can take.
Yeah, it ranges from, I believe, soldering tools to hammers and everything in between. I mean, for us, we can't really bring along a giant giant tool to bring along with us, but there's a lot of things that we can bring with us.
Is it fun?
It definitely is. It's a lot of stress, but with that stress, there comes a lot of fun, a lot of aha moments, a lot of feelings of, oh, yes, we did this. We put a block in a bucket. You know, although that may seem kind of small, it's really big for a robot.
What do you have to do to prepare for statewide competition? Do you just study?
I think the hardest part for me for preparing for the state competition is trying to decide how much or how little you want to change your robot. It's always the first thought after a competition is always like, you know, we want to completely redo everything that we have and come up with an entirely new system, and it's just not reasonable. You can't do that in a month, so that's kind of hard to prioritize that. But then also moving on from the regional tournament to the state, and as you continue through the different competitions, it gets to be more focused on the non-robot aspects. The robot's important, but they focus more on the gracious professionalism and the notebooks and your presentation as a team and how you work together. So a lot of it is getting to know your team and making sure everybody has something to do all the time.
How many people are on your team?
My team actually has 10.
And my team has 6.
And my team has 6 as well.
Is it interesting working with other people who you may not know that well, or do you get to know them through the course of the competition?
For me, there was a member in my team who was homeschooled, and so I had no idea who that person was. And so we just brought him in, and he joined in, and we got to know each other, and it was something that. Although we didn't know him in the beginning, we know him really well now, and it's been a great competition or a great season.
Super. So state competition is when? You go there tomorrow, is that true?
We leave tomorrow, and the actual competition is, well, the robot game is on Saturday.
And that's in Anchorage?
Oh, yeah, that's in Eagle River at Eagle River High School.
And let's think positive. You win the competition.
Oh, yeah. All three are going to get first place.
What happens after them?
The top five, I think there's 5 slots that move on from competition, and there's 3 Inspire Awards, the first, the second, and third place, and then also the top 2 performing robots and the Connect Award, I think, for community outreach. There's a list, but from state, we go to a super regional competition, which is I don't know how many states, but a few of the Northwest states. And then from the super regionals, if you move on from that, you actually go straight to Worlds.
Well, good luck.
Yes, thank you.
Thank
you. Is
there
anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I think that's it.
Well, thanks for coming by.
Well, thank you so much.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 18th of February. 2016. It's the birthday of the poet Jack Gilbert, Pittsburgh, 1925. Jack Gilbert, who said, "The only things worth writing about are love, death, man, virtue, nature, magnitude, excellence, evil, suffering, courage, morality, what is the good life, what is honor, who am I?" It's the 85th birthday of Chloe Wofford, better known to us as Toni Morrison, born Lorain, Ohio, 1931. It was a small town, 1 high school, 1 church, 4 elementary schools. Morrison said, "We were all pretty much very, very poor." Her mother loved to sing, sang opera, sang the blues. The girl went off to Howard University, studied literature, got a job editing textbooks for Random House. moved to Syracuse. She was a single mother, two young boys, and she started writing then in earnest. She said, I was in a place where I knew I was not going to be for a long time. I didn't have any friends, didn't make any, didn't want any, because I was on my way somewhere else. So I wrote as a thing to do. Her first book was The Bluest Eye, came out in 1970. Left her publishing job to write full-time, and in 1987 published Beloved. Inspired by the real-life story of Margaret Garner, a woman who escaped slavery in 1856, fled from Kentucky, husband and children, made it across the Ohio River, and then was caught, and she killed her young daughter rather than allow her to be taken back into slavery. Toni Morrison's latest novel, God Help the Child, which came out last year. And it's the birthday of Nikos Kazantzakis, born in Heraklion, Crete, 1883, author of Zorba the Greek, came out when he was 56. And a few years later, a book, The Last Temptation, which was condemned by the church because it presented a Christ who wanted to cast off his divinity. Here's a poem for today by Jack Gilbert entitled Failing and Flying. Everyone forgets that Icarus also flew. It's the same when love comes to an end or the marriage fails and people say they knew it was a mistake, that everybody said it would never work, that she was old enough to know better. But anything worth doing is worth doing badly. Like being there by that summer ocean on the other side of the island while love was fading out of her, the stars burning so extravagantly those nights that anyone could tell you they would never last. Every morning she was asleep in my bed like a visitation, the gentleness in her like antelope standing in the dawn mist. Each afternoon I watched her coming back through the hot, stony field after swimming, the sea light behind her and the huge sky on the other side of that. Listened to her while we ate lunch. How can they say the marriage failed? Like the people who came back from Provence when it was Provence and said it was pretty, but the food was greasy. I believe Icarus was not failing as he fell, but just coming to the end of his triumph. A poem by Jack Gilbert, Failing and Flying, from Refusing Heaven, published by Knopf and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can subscribe to the Poetry Magazine podcast and the Poetry Off the Shelf podcast in the iTunes Store, or listen at poetryfoundation.org. And by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This month's Barn Dance is this Saturday, February 20th, 7:30 p.m. at St. Anne's Parish Hall on 5th Street downtown. There's always live music, and Full Circle String Band will be on hand to play Celtic and New England tunes, and Susie Kendig will teach and call contradances. As always, you don't need any experience or a partner, just be ready for a fun and friendly atmosphere. Student and senior discounts and free for JVs and AmeriCorps, sponsored by the Juno Folk Dancers, with help from KTOO. Barn Dance, Saturday.
Are the effects of shorter days and less light getting to you? Have you lost your motivation? Don't brush off that yearly feeling. It's simply a case of the winter blues that you have to tough out on your own. Take steps to keep your mood and motivation steady throughout the year by staying active. But if you find this isn't enough, talk with a professional. If you are struggling, Search can help. Contact the Search helpline at 877-294-0074.
It's about 14 minutes before the hour, and you're on tune to June afternoon. And our last guest is Nancy DeCherney from the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council.
Hey, Jeff.
How is that wearable art show?
Well, I thought it was pretty good. What did you think?
I thought it was great.
You caught a few stars. I thought it was one of the best, actually. Sunday especially was my favorite. But I'm glad that it's over, and now we have a whole bunch of things for you to do this week. I hope everybody got a little rest. There's a documentary happening downstairs in 360 North tonight at 6:30. It's the Flying University. It seems to be something between UAS and the Lemon Creek Correctional Facility. Is it a discussion of justice and such? You know,
Scott Byrne produced a video.
Yeah. So that'll be shown in 360 North. It's free. Come on down. There's Bluegrass Thursday over at the Red Dog Saloon. There's Tango Dancing out at Suite 907. There's a Backcountry Film Fest. Is that this week? Winter Wildlands Alliance at Rockwell. There's the Young Dubliners on Thursday night. They will be out at Suite 907. Their Fire on McGinnis opens for them at 7, and then Young Dubliners are at 9. And you can get tickets at Suite 907, at the bookstores, online, all the usual places. So they're wonderful. People should stop and see them. We have on Friday at 5:30 p.m. a Day of Remembrance, the Empty Chair out at the Mendenhall Public Library. This is a free event. Traveler Duo is at Rockwell at 6 p.m. You can learn to skate over at the Skating Club. It is at 7 p.m. Celestial Myths Busted. Go ahead and say that several times. That's over at Marie Drake Planetarium, and that's free. But what we really want everybody coming to do is at 7:30, we've got Motown for Our Town. The guys that come to town to do the gospel music also do this fabulous Motown thing. And actually, Shona Osterhout, Mike Gamble, and Jocelyn Miles will be competing to be the king or queen of Motown for the year. So they've got quite a lineup. You know, there's some backup dancers and all sorts of stuff. They'll be dancing down the aisles. It'll be great. There's sweet potato pie, and that alone is worth the price of admission. Although you have to buy the pie, too. It's a fundraiser for the Juneau Black Awareness. That's tonight, or Friday night at 7:30 p.m. at the Jack. And then you go from there at 9 p.m. You can go out to the adult prom at Suite 907. They have the band Color Me Bad. So you got a whole evening Friday night. On Saturday at 10:30 in the morning up at the Juneau Douglas City Museum, it's Coffee and Collections with Avery Skaggs. His life, it's entitled My Life as an Artist. That's free, and they usually have nice baked goods and nice coffee from Heritage, so check that out. Colors of the Cosmos, the Planetarium, 7 p.m. And then, as we just heard, there's a barn dance up at St. Anne Parish Hall. Full Circle music is playing. And let's see, at 8:30 to 10:30, over at the Rendezvous, Stop Dragging My Heart Around, A Tale of Love Through the Eyes of a Drag. $5, must be 21 to get in. Sounds like a lot of fun. Try that out on Saturday. On Sunday, you got the ukulele jam, as always, over at T.K. McGuire's. From 11:30 to 2, the Alaska Women's Lobby is offering the first Carla Timpone Award Luncheon. It'll be at the Dragon Inn, and tickets are available on their website. They are recognizing Nancy Barnes, M.K. McNaughton, and Walter Majoros for their work on behalf of Alaskan women. So a new exciting thing for us to be doing. But out at Thunder Mountain High School at 2 p.m. and at 5:30 p.m., we have the gospel celebrations. We've always sold the Jack out with this event, so we thought we would try a venue a little bit bigger and also try something out in the valley for all the folks out there. You can get tickets at Hearthside Books, at our place, online, all that sort of stuff. This is really one of the most uplifting. You know, we've had kind of a rough winter, I think, in Juneau. I think we need this. So it's one of the most uplifting and
you've been listening to these
joyous.
People. You've been listening to these people, yes, practice all day long.
And all into the evening, and it's beautiful. They're backed up by Clay Good and Bill Ashby, and I just have to say, if you need a little boost in your spirits, this is the thing to do. 2 p.m. and 5:30 gospel out at Thunder Mountain High School on Sunday. At 6 p.m., there is the Alaska School Council of School Administrators is having a student art exhibit. It's a reception for legislators at the Jack. There's international folk dancing over at the Alaska Club and karaoke out at Suite 907. On Monday, the Tlingit Language Learners Group is at the Downtown Public Library at 6 p.m. That's free. And there's Skiers Friday over at Hangar in the Wharf at 6:30 p.m. on Monday. On Tuesday, we've got Lego League, and there's a Free Flight Film Festival, which is a fundraiser for the Trail Mix and Juno Raptor Center. That is at Goldtown Nickelodeon. You need to be 21, and it's by donation, so come and support Trail Mix and the Raptor Center by watching a film. And at 7 p.m., there's West Coast Swing Dancing out at 907. On Wednesday, what everybody wants to do is come to the Arts Council board meeting. I'm just sure of it. That's at 5. It's in the gallery, and it is open to the public, but I'll understand if I don't see you there.
What's the dress code?
Casual. At 5 p.m., Turkey Caught in the Middle East with, I'm not sure how to say the person's name, Sinan Sidi, and that's at your downtown studios, too, I think, or the studios here at K2. And then there's the weekly old-time music jam at the Alaskan Hotel and Bar. So check all these things out. Again, if you need more information, you can come to our website at www.jahc and click on the calendar to get more details like phone numbers and prices and all that sort of stuff. Or you can go to k2.org. They have the same calendar.
Yes, there's nothing to do.
Really, is there? And plus it's sunny, and so everybody wants to go hiking and everything. It's just exciting. I can't believe it.
Anthony, Jimmy, thank you for coming by.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. A hawk is hunting in the kingdom of cars and 18-wheelers.
This is the American dream of freedom on wheels. An automotive age traveling on time-saving superhighways.
In 1956, the Eisenhower administration announced plans for the nation's new interstate highway system. 41,000 miles of superior highways with limited on-off access, multiple lanes for high-speed travel, and often a grassy border on either side and down the middle. These grassy byproducts of highway construction created ribbons of wildlife habitat, soon occupied by small mammals such as voles, favorite prey of the red-tailed hawk and other raptors that are now common along many stretches of interstate, as are deer, coyotes, and other animals. At a conservative guess, if the average grassy verge is a modest 50 feet wide on each side of the freeway, that's 12 acres of grass per mile of highway. Multiplied by the current 47,000 miles of interstate, that's about 881 square miles of green. And that's only the interstates. There are hundreds of thousands of other highway miles that crisscross the country and often offer equally prosperous hunting grounds for a multitude of birds. Accidental gifts from the age of the automobile. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Join us at 360 for the premiere of The Flying University, a short documentary that profiles a university literature class inside Juno's Lemon Creek Prison.
We're still people. We're human, you know. I mean, it's not like we're any worse or any better than anybody else that comes along in here, you know.
Followed by a forum that discusses justice reform with former inmates, experts, and UAS professor Saul Neely. Thursday, February 18th at 6:30 in the K2 building.
Program support provided by Kindred Post, a full-service post office, gift shop, and community gathering space located downtown at 145 South Franklin Street and open 10 a.m. until 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday. More information at kindredpost.com or on Instagram at kindred_post.
There's nothing quite as powerful as the sound of a woman's voice. For over 35 years, Karen N. has brought you female singer-songwriters and instrumentalists on women's prerogatives.
In a bubble shaped like a beer bottle.
Hey, what you doing today?
Women's Prerogative, music by, for, and about women. Thursday evenings at 7 on KRNN Juno.
Mondays are back
at the Diamond Park Aquatic Center, now open Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. until 8 p.m., Saturdays 9 a.m. until 6 p.m., and Sundays noon until 6 p.m. Schedules are available online at juno.org/parkrec/diamondpark. For more information, call Diamond Park Aquatic Center at 586-2782.
Strong wind is expected today and tomorrow near downtown Juneau. Forecast for tonight, clear skies, low temperatures 20 to 30 degrees above zero. Forecast for Friday, increasing clouds, locally windy weather continuing with high temperatures around 34 degrees. Mostly cloudy skies expected on Friday night. Saturday, snow likely in the morning and rain in the afternoon. Sunday, cloudy skies with a chance of rain and high temperatures around 39 degrees. Thanks for tuning into Juneau Afternoon today. Have a good evening.